Welcome to KUOW Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this week's episode, in 1520, explorer Ferdinand Magellan called it peaceful. At more than 60 million square miles, it covers 30% of the Earth's surface, an area larger than the landmass of all the continents combined. It is our planet's largest and deepest ocean basin, and it has stories to tell. So, where to begin? Author Simon Winchester sees many good starting points, and his writing approaches each one with, as the New York Times notes, an almost tactile sense of the Earth, its history, and its peoples. Winchester's new book is Pacific: Silicon Chips and Surfboards, Coral Reefs and Atom Bombs, Brutal Dictators, Fading Empires, and the Coming Collision of the World's Superpowers. In it, Winchester guides his readers around the Pacific Rim, from the Bering Strait to Cape Horn, the Yangtze River to the Panama Canal, and a place called Bikini. Among many subjects, the journey covers the tragic misadventures of early atomic research, the abuse and pollution of people and places, the geopolitics of the 38th parallel and transistor radios, and the Gidget Revolution. Simon Winchester is English by birth, a geologist and writer by trade, and an American by adoption. His other books include The Professor and the Madman, The Map That Changed the World, Atlantic, and The Men Who United the States. He spoke at Town Hall Seattle on November 4th, 2015. This talk was presented by Town Hall and the Elliott Bay Book Company as part of the Seattle Science Lectures. Thanks to Anna Tatashev for our recording.
Simon Winchester is the acclaimed author of over a dozen books, including Atlantic, The Man Who Loved China, A Crack in the Edge of the World, and the New York Times bestseller, The Professor and the Madman, as well as Skulls. Was anyone here for his event when he talked about the Skulls book a few years ago? That was so cool. He had this iPad app of the book and was manipulating skulls on a screen in front of everybody. That's not what he's here to do tonight. No skull manipulation. He's had a wonderful career as a journalist, writing for publications such as The Guardian, The Sunday Times, and The Daily Mail. In his time as a journalist, he's covered important historical moments, including the Bloody Sunday massacre and the Watergate scandal. His writing has appeared in several travel publications, including Condé Nast Traveler, Smithsonian Magazine, National Geographic. He's an honorary fellow of St. Catherine's College, Oxford, and in 2006, he was made an officer of the Order of the British Empire by Her Majesty the Queen for his services to journalism and literature. His latest book and the topic of our discussion tonight is Pacific, and it was a finalist for the 2015 Kirkus Prize. So please join me in offering a warm town hall welcome back to Simon Winchester.
Well, thanks awfully, and it's really lovely to be back here again. And I have to thank also, I mean, my publicist in New York is so thrilled at the moment because it seems that the Pacific is really hot at the moment. We've got all this. Well, first of all, was it Hurricane Patricia about 3 weeks ago, the biggest hurricane in the world? It was turned out to be a bit of a dud, but I say that from a newspaper man's point of view, and it's a terrible thing to say, I know, but no one was killed, and so we thought, well, it suddenly disappeared off the front pages, but it was huge. And then you've got all this nonsense in the South China Sea at the moment with the American warship being sort of provocative and going close to these little islands. And then over in Britain, you probably won't have seen a great deal of publicity about it here, but the foreign minister of the Marshall Islands, I mean, who knew they had a foreign minister, but they do, and he's in London pleading the case of the Bikini Atoll exiles who, as I'll be referring to in the talk, had to leave their idyllic little atoll to make room for nuclear weapons testing and have been exiled to a miserable little island in the southern Marshall Islands called Kili, which is a double whammy for them, is now being flooded because of rising sea levels. And so the foreign minister has been in London asking whether Britain might take them in as refugees, and I think he's going to be coming to the United States to say the same sort of thing. So to the foreign minister of the Marshall Islands, to whoever the weather gods created, Patricia, and to the Chinese government, my publicist in New York says a very hearty thank you, because But the basic thesis of this book is very simple. It's just I had this idea that the Mediterranean was the inland sea of the classical world, and I think most people would probably agree with that. And if you do, then you can say, hop, skip, and a jump, that the Atlantic is the inland sea of today's world. And if you agree with that, then the Pacific Ocean is the inland sea of tomorrow's world. And so given that basic thesis, I decided a few years ago I'd have a bash at writing a book about it. But how on earth do you write a book about such a massive entity? I mean, the size of the thing is just extraordinary. It occupies, what, one third of the world's surface. You could easily put all the other oceans and the continents into it, and they'd fit with consummate ease. Robinson Jeffers, the great American poet who lived in Big Sur or somewhere near, wrote a poem about it, calling it the great unsleeping eye of the earth. Because when you look at the planet from far away, it's just a big blue expanse that never blinks, and it just watches out in space all the time. So how do you write about it? And I'm a great believer that in writing non-fiction books that there are three components, of which the most important, of course, and it's obvious, is the idea. You've got to have a decent idea for a book. But the second idea, the second component isn't necessarily good writing. I mean, it's jolly nice if you can write it nicely, but it isn't as important as the next most crucial thing, and that's the structure. You've got to get the structure of the book right. You can write lyrically about a marvelous idea, but if the structure's all wrong, you'll lose them. They'll just go to sleep or put the book on the bedside table and never pick it up again. So how to put the Pacific into a compelling structure? Well, when I wrote this book about the Atlantic, that seemed to me rather simpler. I did that according to the Seven Ages of Man from Shakespeare, from As You Like It. So I looked at the Pacific in its, as it were, its infancy, and then its as a school child, and as a lover, a soldier, the justice, old man, and return to childhood. And it all seemed to work quite neatly. And then the most recent book, which was a book about America called The Men Who United the States, the structure for that was the five Chinese elements in Chinese philosophy: wood, earth, water, fire, and metal. And that also seemed to work quite well. But I didn't want to use those same structures again, and I had to come up with a new device for the Pacific. So the first thing I thought about was, well, do I want to try and write about the entire history of the Pacific Ocean? And I thought, no, if my thesis is that the Pacific is the ocean of the future, then I should start the story sometime in relatively modern times. And taking the view that the early figures in the Pacific, like the person who first found it, first European that found it, Balboa, well, actually Balboa is quite interesting because you may remember, if you remember your Keats from school days, he talks about, there's that poem on first looking into Chapman's Homer, and he talks about stout Cortez standing on a peak in Darien in the first time any European had seen the Pacific. And Keats wrote that poem late one night in London, and he showed it to his mentor the next morning. And his mentor said, well, Keats, a lovely sonnet you've written, but it actually wasn't Cortez that saw the Pacific, it was Balboa. And Keats said, yes, but stout Balboa has got four syllables and doesn't scan. So would you mind awfully if I kept the name Cortez in there? And on your own head be it, said the mentor, which has meant that dozens of generations of English and English-speaking school children all around the world have come to this misguided belief that it was actually Cortez that discovered the Pacific. Well, it didn't. It was Balboa. But there's no doubt about who first sailed across it, and that was 9 years later, and that was Magellan. And, of course, he didn't actually get the whole way across because he was murdered in the Philippines. But his name is associated with European adventuring into the Pacific. But nonetheless, I thought that Balboa and Cortez, whatever contribution he made, and Magellan and the others like Captain Cook and Dampier and the earlier explorers of the Pacific, I could sort of take them all as a given, and that I would, maybe there's a brief mention of them in the book, but nothing significant. I would bring it, I'd start the story much more recently. So what date to start the story? Well, I thought possibly the 2nd of September 1945, which was the date of the surrender of the Japanese on board the USS Missouri in Tokyo Bay. That seemed a sort of hinge point of history, as did the 10th of October 1949, which was the founding of the People's Republic of China. That also was when the world, as it were, turned on its axis. But then I came across another date, and that was the 1st of January 1950. And one of the wonderful things that I find about writing these nonfiction books is that I learn so much as I'm going along. I try and do all my own research. And so this was a little thing that I discovered. Maybe you all know it, but I didn't. I mean, a measure of my ignorance, perhaps. It all comes down to the way we count the years of today and yesterday, the system of BC and AD, before Christ and Anno Domini. You know, the Romans invaded Britain, 55 BC. This is 2015 Anno Domini. But we're not all Christians, of course. And so to a lot of people, this is either offensive or irrelevant. So about 30 or 40 years ago, people involved in talking about antique things came up with a fudge, and that's what many of us use today, which is BCE, which is before Christian era, for those who have a lingering affection for the Christian way of doing things, or before Common era, which is somewhat more secular. But the scientists and the scientific community didn't accept that, and they much preferred a completely different convention, which equally they invented or came up with about 30 or 40 years ago, which was BP. You talk about the Wisconsin Ice Age, for instance, as having occurred 10,000 years BP. And BP, of course, stands for before present. But that then prompts the question, well, when is present? Well, present was decided about 20 years ago by a group of radiochemists in, of all places, Queen's University, Belfast. The index year for present would be 1950, and the beginning of present is reckoned to be the 1st of January 1950, and for a very good reason. It's a reason I can get incredibly boring about, so I'll try not to. But it's all to do with carbon dating, because before 1950, the ratio between, in carbon dioxide, there's a fixed ratio between the stable isotope of carbon, carbon-12, and the unstable carbon-14, which, as you may remember from school, has a half-life. Half of it disappears after 7,530 years. That's an important number to remember. So what this means is that if we know the ratio, and it is about for every trillion atoms of carbon-12, there is one atom of carbon-14. If we know that, and let's say a tree dies way back in history and stops absorbing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, then the moment it stops absorbing it, the amount of carbon-12 in it will remain the same, because carbon-12 is a stable isotope. But after 7,530 years, the ratio between the two will have changed, because the carbon-14, half of it will have disappeared. And after another 7,530 years, what remains, there'll be only half of that left. And so it's very easy to calculate how long ago the tree died. So carbon-14 dating was a very accurate way of learning when organic material died. However, come 1950, the world became polluted with much more carbon-14 because of nuclear testing. It was every time an atomic bomb went off, one of the byproducts of both fission bombs and fusion bombs is carbon-14. So suddenly that ratio went completely wacko. And they had to, in 1951, introduce an algorithm, and then in 1952, another algorithm. And the radiochemists were tearing their hair out, because all of a sudden, carbon-14 dating was inaccurate. And so these people at Queen's University said, OK, well, the world changed in a very significant way in 1950. Before 1950, we can say, the world was pure. And after 1950, it became, and still remains, impure. And so, since nearly all of the impurities were generated in the Pacific Ocean, because that's where most of the testing occurred, that seemed to me to be the perfect start point for this book. So I chose the 1st of January 1950 to start the book, and for a reason I'll discuss a wee bit later, the 14th of May 2014 to end it. So I'm telling the story of the Pacific over 65 or 64 years. So then what sort of a structure should I adopt? And what I thought I'd do was to trawl through all the news events and all the archives of everything that I could see happened of any significance in and around the Pacific during those 64 years, and then try and discern from those to try and winnow out 10, because I think 10 chapters is a number of chapters that's easy for people to handle, 10 events that were of such either supreme importance or interest that they betokened a trend that would, at the end, you would say, well, that is what the Pacific is all about today. So that's what I did. I must have looked through all these newspapers and came up with about 250 or 300 events, and then went through, I mean, the thing about the cutting room floor, it's always filled inevitably with hundreds of small tragedies, and you get very excited about one event, and then you say it's not quite relevant in it. And you, so in the end, I came up with 10 things that happened in chronological order from the 1st of January 1950 up to 2014. And this is my take on the Pacific. And whether I've done well or ill, we'll see what the critics have to say. And thus far, they've been very kind. The New York Times on Monday was absolutely wonderful. So I'm crossing my fingers that everything's going to be okay. So what I thought I'd do is very briefly, and I'm not going to go through each, to your enormous relief, I dare say, go through all 10 of the chapters, but just sketch out roughly the sort of thing I had in mind. So chapter one, so remember the 1st of January 1950 is when it begins, the first event of true significance was on the 4th of January, so just 4 days later, 4th of January 1950, which was when President Truman stood up before the Joint Houses of Congress and announced two things. One, that the United States was about to begin the development of a completely new type of nuclear weapon. As you know, from the 1940s, they had been making an atom bomb, a fission bomb, and they had dropped two of them on Hiroshima and Nagasaki to lethal effect. But the scientists had now said that it was possible to develop a new type of weapon, a fusion bomb, a hydrogen bomb, a thermonuclear bomb, and America was now going to do that. And so that was the first thing that Truman said. And the second thing was that they were going to test these weapons in the Pacific Ocean. So that's what they eventually did. And so the chapter recounts the tale of how they did it, and I will in a moment tell one particular and I think rather alarming story of an aspect of that. But I'm still sort of horrified, and I should say parenthetically that an awful lot of this book is about how Westerners have mistreated and maltreated the ocean and its people. There's a famous Australian book by a man called Alan Moorhead about 40 years ago called The Fatal Impact, which is how once we Westerners came, we brought diseases and slavery and disdain and disrespect and treated the islanders and the people on the periphery of the Pacific very badly. And there's an awful lot of that in this book. I mean, it's not unremitting gloom, but the first chapter is fairly gloomy. And the kind of thing that went on, which I think is so incredibly cynical, they decided on Bikini, which is an atoll conveniently close to a very big airfield in the southern Marshall Islands called Kwajalein. And so what they knew about Bikini was that the few people that lived there, who lived perfectly blameless lives, they just fished and collected coconuts and grew some vegetables and mended their nets and had never been a trouble to anybody. Their life was, one might say, idyllic, impoverished but idyllic. But they were all Christians. They were made Christians because 19th century missionaries, I mean, great interferers, I have no great time for missionaries, came on and said, oh, you've got to stop being naked, you've all got to wear Mother Hubbards, and here is the Bible, which we've kindly translated into Marshallese. And they became Christians. So when the Americans, and if I say the Americans, I'm not a foreigner anymore, I am an American, so I'm talking about my own people. I share the blame with all of you guys, I promise you. When they decided to test the weapons on Bikini, they thought, they're Christians. Well, there's a way we can persuade these people that dropping bombs is a very good idea. It all has to do with the pillar of fire that was the signal for the Israelites, if you remember in the Bible, to to move out of or into the Holy Land. I can't remember which direction they were going. But anyway, the pillar of fire is the crucial thing. So this young commodore or commander came from the Pentagon, a fresh-faced young man, and you can see the extraordinary YouTube video of these people, these Bikinians gathered around him on the sand under the coconut trees with the Pacific beating in the distance, an idyllic scene. And this young man is saying to them, I'm come here from the United States government on a mission for peace. And what I'm, you will have read, will you not, everybody, about the signal that the good Lord sent to the Israelites, a pillar of fire. Well, we now have a device which can create a pillar of fire, and we're going to create, with your permission, a pillar of fire here. And we'd like you to leave. This pillar should be a signal to you that you should leave while we do God's work. And the islanders said, well, that sounds a pretty reasonable argument. Yes, okay, we will leave. And so they did leave. And so the Americans tested these weapons, which did indeed produce pillars of fire. And the islanders have never, this is 1950, that's what, 65 years ago, have never been able to go back. Their island has been completely ruined and devastated, and their lives have been shot to pieces, quite literally. So that whole chapter is about, it's called the Great Thermonuclear Sea. Mercifully, you know, most countries stopped nuclear testing, except, of course, the French, who, being French, continued testing for quite a long while afterwards. But they would, wouldn't they? So, but chapter two is a rather more genial chapter. So we've moved from 1950, it's now 1955, August the 8th, I think it is. And that relates to a small event which occurred, first of all, in the city of Edmonton in Alberta. And extraordinary, I'd forgotten, but I was in Edmonton. They had a little literary festival about 2 weeks ago, and I was in there, and I was able to say, gosh, yes, I didn't realize I'm in Edmonton, where this event happened. I mean, Edmonton very rarely gets written about, and with some reason. Seriously, it is a really, it's not a very nice city, I have to say. I hope I'm not offending anybody. I mean, someone came up to me yesterday in San Francisco and said he was at the University of Alberta. But it is, when I was there anyway, it was dark and cold, it was beginning to snow, there are no trees, all the buildings were built in the 1970s. My hotel was ghastly in the room. Anyway, but there was an electronics store on Jasper Street in Edmonton, and another store in Winnipeg, and another store in Vancouver. And on August the 8th in 1955, in these three stores, simultaneously was unveiled a small device, a small shirt pocket-sized radio set. Up to that moment, radios were pieces of furniture. They were covered with walnut veneer, and you had the corner of the living room, and you put the aspidistra on top, and you turned them on, and they warmed up, and you tuned them in. But this device produced exactly the same sound, or news, or concerts, or theatre, or whatever you wanted to listen to, and you could take it out into the garden, you could take it to bed, you could take it to school. It was your own personal radio set. And it was, of course, the first ever transistor radio. It was called the TR-55, and it was made in Japan by a company. You could see its name written around the tuning dial at the top. It said Totsco, which is Tokyo Telecommunications Company. And underneath, in tiny little letters, was a word quite unfamiliar to people, which would soon become one of the most familiar words in the English language, and that is the word Sony. So this was the first ever Sony device, and it was invented in Japan by an extraordinary man called Masaru Ibuka. Now, when we think of Sony, we tend to think of this rather sleek, silver-haired smoothie, Akio Morita, who is the sort of public face of Sony, the PR face, if you like. But Ibuka was a tough, working-class Tokyo engineer and an amazing inventor as well. He invented the transistor radio. He invented the Walkman, if you remember the Walkman. He invented the Trinitron television. He invented the Betamax. I mean, he was an extraordinary fellow. So this thing appeared in Canada, and it was snapped up almost immediately. About a month later, a shipment of them, I think 4,000 of them, arrived in the United States in New York. And they were in a warehouse in Queens with a lot of other electronic equipment. And extraordinarily, and I often wonder whether this was actually a Sony-inspired crime that was committed, there was a burglary. And the thieves, it was reported on page 17 of the New York Times of this particular day, I think in November of that same year, 1955, that heist in Queens Warehouse. And it said that the burglars had taken only these radios. They'd left behind all the other electronic equipment worth a considerable amount of money, but they wanted these 4,000 new tiny shirt pocket-sized radios made by Sony. And New Yorkers read this and said, effectively, well, it's good enough for the burglars, it's good enough for us, and they ordered them in huge numbers, and suddenly Sony took off. And the interesting thing is that on the other side of the world, well, actually, not on the other side of the world, but the other side of the world from where these radios were made, the shipping container was invented. And so all of a sudden, in late 1955, you had the very first container ships being built in shipyards in Korea and Japan with these American-made containers, which had been made in New Jersey, on top, filled initially with thousands upon thousands of these radios and then other electronic devices. And so Masaru Ibuka's invention was the start of this enormously, this new and hugely significant pattern of trade from west to east of Japanese electronics and precision instruments and cameras, televisions, and all the things that we've known ever since. Japan, of course, was in the ascendant for many years, and then it, you know, companies like Panasonic and so forth, and then it switched to Korea because they had lower production prices, and so companies like Samsung, and now, of course, it's China. But every time you stand on the Golden Gate Bridge or on the harbour here and you see these enormous evergreen container ships coming in, it is worth remembering that the start of this trend was the making of a tiny little shirt pocket-sized radio, the TR-55, which appeared in Edmonton, Alberta, on the 8th of August 1955. So the third event, and I do promise you, I mean, it's not going to be laborious, I'm not going to be saying in a few minutes that the 11th event was... The third event, just sort of lightens the subject a little, was the 23rd of April, Shakespeare's birthday, 1959, when a movie was opened in Long Island. It was a movie made by Columbia Pictures, and they didn't have the confidence in it that it would be worth opening in the big cities, not in Manhattan. So they opened it in the suburbs. But the New York Times movie critic had wind of it and went to see it and was enraptured by it and wrote a lyrical critique of it. I mean, lyrical to the extent that the New York Times in 1959 wrote anything lyrically, saying this is an absolute must-see film for anyone that's wanting to go to the beach this summer. And this film, you may have seen it, was called Gidget. I know, it sounds awfully trivial, but it's not as trivial as you may think, because this is the story of a young girl called Kathy Kona, who was 14 and a half or 15, and she learned how to surf. And the whole story of surfing I find fascinating. It's a sport that began in the middle of the Pacific in Tahiti in central Polynesia 500 or 600 years ago. It was a very well-known traditional sport. It migrated to Hawaii, and the seeds of it were in Hawaii in the 19th century. The missionaries came along, with bad effect, of course, as usually. The Hawaiians had a very rigid sort of pecking order as far as who would surf. The aristocracy, these gigantic men from the princely families who were sort of rather corpulent, eating poi all the time, this taro plant mash, would surf one on boards that were 21 feet long. I mean, three times as tall as they were, gigantic boards, whereas the common people used shorter boards and the children, tiny little boards called paipo. So the missionaries came along and noticed to their horror that these Hawaiians, particularly the horror for the big fellows, surfed completely naked. And the women missionaries said, this cannot stand. And they said to the Hawaiians, look, you've got to give up. You've either got to wear muumuus when you surf. And they said, you know, lady, get out of here. We cannot surf wearing a muumuu. It sort of takes the fun out of it. Or you've got to stop surfing. And effectively, they did. Surfing died in Hawaii, except for the children. And in 1907, Jack London came by in the Snark, and he and his wife were swimming one afternoon in Waikiki, which was a little village, and suddenly he was overtaken by dozens of these adorable little children, all zipping along on the top of the waves on these tiny little paupo boards, they're called. And he thought, this is a magical sport. I must learn how to do it. And so he did. I mean, he was a lumbering, big white guy, and he didn't think, he thought this was something that only Polynesians could do. But he learned how to do it, and there's that magical moment when you finally do manage to stand up on the top of a wave and you're brought in to shore and you feel as if you're flying. And so he wrote this extraordinary piece, Surfing the King of Sports, which appeared in the Women's Home Companion of all magazines. I know, it's crazy. October 1907. And this kick-started the sport of surfing in the United States. And so within the piece was syndicated. It was in the Pall Mall Gazette in London. It was in a magazine in Australia. And soon surfing beaches were being opened around the periphery of the Pacific. Redondo Beach in California was one of the first ones. Malibu, and then Bondi Beach in Australia. But it didn't go much beyond that until 1959, and suddenly Gidget appeared, and the American public suddenly thought, my God, you know, if a 14-year-old girl can do this, then we can do it. And it became a worldwide phenomenon. It's now a $13 billion a year industry. And interestingly, and this is why it's more important than merely a disquisition on the Pacific's gift to playtime, which is what you might think surfing is, an awful lot of management techniques are based on surfing. And for instance, Patagonia, the clothing company, that was started by a man called Yvon Chouinard, who loved to surf. And he built his initial factories on the Pacific Coast Highway within sight of surfing beaches and would say to his employees, when the surf's up, go surfing. And then when the surf abates or you're tired, come back and work for me and you'll be happy and you'll put in, you know, you'll think of me as a good employer. And they did. And so that technique of the beginning of flex time, which is now very much the technique in many of the West Coast companies, the high technology companies, was born effectively from the sport of surfing. And the nice personal coda for me about all of this is that last week, actually this week, Monday, I got an email from Gidget. Gidget, Kathy Kona, is now Kathy Zimmerman, and she's 72, I think, still surfs every day, lives in Malibu. She works 2 days a week in a bookstore, came across this book, read it and said, my God, you've written all about me and how I've changed management techniques and spawned a whole worldwide... Well, can we have lunch? So I am having lunch with Gidget next week, and I'm completely thrilled. Well, as I said, I'm not going to go through any more of the chapters, but what I want to do is to extract three things, and in fact, I think I'll only have time for two, things that I discovered when I was writing this book, which just stunned or amazed or amused me, and I hope you might interest you. Because as I say, to repeat this rather obvious point, one of the delights is that I'm constantly learning things. And one, I don't want you to think the book, I'm obsessed with nuclear weapons, but this is related to the nuclear story. And it illustrates the sort of the callous indifference that I think many Westerners have displayed towards the Pacific Ocean. The last thing I'm going to talk about this afternoon, this evening, is much more hopeful. But the first of these stories is about this callous indifference, the kind of thing that if you look into the eyes of any of those wonderful portraits that Gauguin did of these women in the Marquesas and how unhappy they are as a result of the lives we have compelled them to live. Anyway, I love to find a villain, and there's a villain in this story, generally an unknown man called Alvin Graves. And Alvin Graves was a nuclear physicist who worked at Los Alamos in the 1940s. And some of you may have seen the story I'm about to tell. There's a film which was made in which this is a scene which, if you see it, is utterly memorable, but maybe not all of you have seen it. It involves an experiment with one of a core of a bomb that they're manufacturing or testing. They have made two incredibly precisely machined hemispheres of plutonium with very, very flat surfaces. And if you put both of them together, one hemisphere on the top of the other, then that would be a critical mass and the thing would explode. So you keep them apart from each other. And the experiment that they wanted to conduct on this particular day in early 1945 is called tickling the dragon's tail. They want to see how close you can get the two hemispheres to one another. So if you can imagine the scene, it's being conducted by another physicist, a colleague of Alvin Graves, called Louis Slotin, who's from Brooklyn in New York. So he's in a laboratory. I suppose now I'm an American, I should say laboratory, but he's in a workroom with five or six other nuclear physicists. There's a wall of beryllium bricks in front of him, protecting him and his chest from radiation. And behind it is a small steel sort of plinth. And on it, with the flat side upwards, is one of these hemispheres of plutonium shielded by beryllium. On top of it, but separated from it by the blade of a screwdriver held in a vertical position, is the other hemisphere. And so he begins the experiment. He asks everyone if they're ready, and he turns the screwdriver by maybe 5 degrees, allowing the upper hemisphere to descend very slightly by about maybe half a millimeter towards the lower hemisphere. And instantly, all the Geiger counters go crazy, the chattering, the noise of the counters, all the radiation detectors, the needles start moving off to the right. He holds it there for maybe 10 seconds and then returns the screwdriver to vertical, and the reaction stops. And everyone takes a note of what they've seen, and he says, OK, we're going to do it again, this time a little bit more. So he turns the screwdriver maybe 15 degrees, which lowers the upper hemisphere by maybe 2 millimeters. And the Geiger counters go crazy, even more so, and the needles all go off to the near the end of the scale. And then he returns it to vertical again, everything quietens down, everything is calm. And then he's just about to do it for the third time, and someone in the room drops a teacup, which breaks, and this startles him, and he pulls the screwdriver out completely, and the upper hemisphere falls flat onto the lower hemisphere. And instantly, there's a flash of this brilliant blue, it's called Cherenkov radiation, and the room is flooded with gamma rays, and everything goes off the charts, the Geiger counters go completely insane. And he realizes there's only one thing he can do. He reaches with his right hand over the wall of beryllium bricks, puts his hand on top of the upper hemisphere and pushes it onto the floor. It falls to the floor and the reaction stops. And he shouts to everybody, stay where you are. And he throws dosimeters at them all, including Graves, who's standing right behind him, and does some very quick calculations on body mass, distance from the source of the radiation and so forth. And then he says, okay, you're okay, you're okay, you're okay. You, Mr. Graves, are probably going to die, and I am definitely going to die, and I'm going to die in 9 days. And he's exactly right. 9 days later, with his hand swollen up the size of a football with edema, he dies from acute radiation poisoning. Alvin Graves, protected by Slotin's body, nonetheless is incredibly ill and hovers on the edge of death for some months. But with transfusions and care, transplants of one sort or another, he actually pulls through. He's a year in hospital and is released finally in 1946, early 1947, and the only physical damage is a small patch of baldness on his head. Otherwise, he's fine. But the major change in him is psychological. He now says, radiation is no big deal. Any strong man can withstand radiation. It is a fiction concocted by weak people that radiation is a bad thing. So fast forward to 1954, when the Atomic Energy Commission, who employs him, is testing the really big bombs on Bikini Atoll. Who do they appoint to be director of what are called the Castle series of tests but Alvin Graves? And there comes this incredible moment when they're testing the second of these two big bombs, the Castle Bravo experiment. Castle Bravo, basically the weapon is, I can't extend my arms that far, it's a cylinder 10 feet long, effectively, filled, it's got a trigger, which is a conventional atom bomb, and then the rest of it is filled with a substance called lithium dihydride, which is going to produce hydrogen, which will then be compressed by the explosion and will become like the sun. they have grossly miscalculated. And so what they had imagined this test would produce was an equivalent of 17 megatons of TNT. You've got to remember that the Hiroshima bomb was 25 kilotons, so this is hugely much more powerful. In fact, they miscalculated, and it turned out to be 50 megatons, the biggest bomb the United States has ever tested in the entire history of nuclear testing. But the thing about it that's crucial, and where Graves' insouciance about radiation it becomes important, is the direction of the wind when the test occurred. The wind was blowing to the northwest, and northwest of Bikini, hundreds of miles of empty sea. There were no ships. The American government had made sure it set out a notice to mariners to keep away. But the night before the test, the wind shifted unexpectedly to be blowing due east. And due east, there were two islands, Rongelap and Rongerik, heavily populated with people. Everyone pleaded with Graves. He said, you cannot fire this weapon with people downwind. They are going to get irradiated. And he said, because his mind was so changed by the experience back in Los Alamos, radiation, they're big, strong people, they'll be fine. Don't worry about it. The Navy, the Army, the civilians that were there said, Graves, don't do it. He said, I'm in charge, I'm going to fire it. It was scheduled for 6 a.m. on the 1st of March 1954, and at 6 a.m. he ordered the button pressed. The button was pressed, and the biggest of all explosions ever occurred, a titanic explosion. The light was phenomenal, the pillar of fire, 25 miles high. The cauliflower, it was called, not a mushroom cloud, but the cauliflower was 60 miles across. And the people on Rongerik and Rongelap saw it. I mean, it looked like a huge sun suddenly rising in the west, and they were just going out for their morning fishing. They were getting coconuts. They were just doing all the peaceful quotidian details of a typical Pacific day. The immense thunder from this explosion, they didn't know what it was because they'd never been told what it was. And then within half an hour, suddenly white crystals started coming down from the sky. And they said to themselves, this must be the snow that we've heard about from Western people. And they would catch it in their hands and taste it and lick it. And this was calcined and heavily radioactive coral fragments. Well, within an hour, they were staggering, they were sick, they were vomiting, there were all sorts of problems. And what did the American government do? It said, my word, this is interesting. We've got a group of people who are being subject to radiation. Let's just watch what happens to them. We won't go and rescue them. We'll just watch what happens. And for 5 days, these poor people, getting sicker and sicker, were observed from a distance. And then finally, a man in Washington, Harold Ikes, said, this is monstrous. These people have got to be taken away and treated. And they were taken away, and they were taken to Kwajalein Atoll and lived there in tents for many months, still being observed, never compensated. And they started to die, and women that were pregnant, you know, aborted, or fetuses were malformed. And there's been a cascade of consequences of this. And Alvin Graves got away with it. No one ever criticized him, and he died peacefully at home in, I think, 1964. So that's one example of a callous, careless outlook that Westerners often have, it seems, in the management of the Pacific. The second story, and I must keep an eye on the clock, relates to North Korea. There's a big chapter on North Korea in this book. I'm fascinated with North Korea. I've been three times now, and I'll just tell you one small story from North Korea before I get on to the thing I really want to talk about, which is that some of you may have been to the crossing point in the DMZ at Panmunjom. Has anyone been there? Well, yeah, okay. A fascinating place where the peace talks, such as they are, take place, and there's a crossing point there. If you go as a tourist, and you can do it from Seoul, you will stand on the southern side overlooking the huts and the actual line itself and then into North Korea, and there are the propaganda speakers blaring, you know, Kim Il-sungisms at you. There is a rather ornate building you can see exactly opposite the one you're standing on, and the Americans will say to you, that, you know, it's called Panmunjom. That is a facade. It's just like a Hollywood set. It's just at the front, and there are balks of timber keeping it up. Well, it's not. I mean, when I've been there from Pyongyang and come south, it's a perfectly normal building. And it's a reminder that truth is a fugitive thing at the place where people are at war or so hostile to each other. So I'm standing there on this day in front of this building, the building that is a building, Panmunjom, and I'm looking south at the American soldiers who are standing on the other side. And the American soldiers at Panmunjom, always chosen, enormous men. I mean, they're sort of 6'6" and built like brick, you know, and to intimidate the North Korean soldiers. So I'm looking at some chap who's looking at me through a very powerful telephoto lens, and I'm looking at him through a pair of binoculars, and we make eye contact. And clearly he's thinking, who is this white guy? Is he some Bulgarian, you know, Communist Party official or something? And I want desperately to say, you know, I'm one of you guys. I mean, I'm a friend. So I'm looking directly at him. He's maybe half a mile away over this incredibly fortified border. So I pathetically decide to wave my hands, and I go like that. And he, with his huge lens, responds with a major sense of humor failure simply by going like that. But anyway, that's not what I wanted to talk about. Well, but it's just a reminder of how the situation is getting no better in the Korea. The thing that I found fascinating was that North Korea was created by an American, and an American with a wonderful name, a wonderful and memorable name, Charles Hartwell Bonesteel III. I mean, that's a superb name, I think. The situation was this. It was the 14th of August, 1945. Charles Hartwell Bonesteel III was a young colonel. His colleague, someone you will remember the name, was Dean Rusk, Colonel Dean Rusk, who went on to be Secretary of State in John Kennedy's administration. The two of them were in the outer office of George Marshall, who was the Chief of Staff of the U.S. Army in the Pentagon. And they were listening over the shortwave radio to Emperor Hirohito over in Japan, where it was the 15th of August, issuing the surrender. This thin, reedy voice speaking this very formal Japanese. People in Japan had never heard his voice before. And he was uttering these words, the greatest understatement of all time. I think the progress of the war has not necessarily gone to our advantage, I'll say. And so we're surrendering. And so Bonesteel and Rusk said effectively, well, that's that. That's the Japanese problem over. But the real problem is this new one, which is the Soviets, because the Soviet Union had entered the war very cynically about 8 days before. And their troops were rushing southwards through all the Japanese occupied territories and taking Soviet control away from the Japanese. So they were coming down through Sakhalin Island, coming down through Manchuria, coming down through Korea. And there was the fear that all of Northeast Asia would become a Soviet satrapy, if you like. Japan would be part of an extension of the Soviet Union, and America did not want that to happen. So it was imperative that the Soviets be ordered or asked to stop. But where? Well, on the desk, of Bonesteel's desk, was a 1944 edition of the National Geographic magazine. And in it, as you may remember, there was a map. And he opened it up, and it was a map of Japan and the North Pacific. And he laid it out. The map still exists. He laid it out on his desk, and he and Rusk looked at it. And Bonesteel said, isn't it droll that San Francisco and Seoul, the capital of Korea, and of course Korea is now at that moment a Japanese colony, are on almost exactly the same latitude, 37 degrees 40 north. I think, Rusk, he said, that it would behoove the Americans to have Seoul, the capital, in our hands. So why don't we ask the Russians to stop just north of Seoul? And how about the 38th parallel? That looks neat. And Rusk said, yeah, 38th parallels. Let's go and ask Marshall. So they went into George Marshall's office and said, what do you think? And he said, yes, I think 38th parallel, a capital idea. So he told the State Department, who asked Moscow, and astonishingly, the next day, the 16th of August, Moscow cabled back to say, you know, our troops are very tired. We've been going, it's the height of summer in Manchuria, the mosquitoes are terrible, the infantry is being bitten, the tanks are being slowed down by the mud. We will stop, as you agree, at the 38th parallel, and you can have Seoul, you can land your troops and take the surrender of the Japanese in the south. So as a result of that, the Soviets appointed their man on the spot, who was Kim Il-sung, And the Americans appointed their man on the spot, who was Ri Sing Man or Sing Man Ri, and two completely different and totally mutually hostile countries were born, which went to war in the 1950s, the peace treaty 1953, the DMZ, the Kim dynasty up north, the testing of nuclear weapons and all sorts of things, and all created by this stroke of a chinagraph pencil on a National Geographic map one August evening in Washington. But there's a nice coda to this as well, because the story that I choose to tell in this book is about the capture of the American spy ship, the USS Pueblo, in 1968. You may remember it. The ship was brought into the port of Wonsan. It's now in Pyongyang, where it's a tourist attraction. The American Navy still regards it as a commissioned warship on active service, but just temporarily withdrawn from duty, 50 years or something. But the 80 sailors were treated abominably. They were interrogated, they were tortured, they were starved, they were beaten up. They had a horrible, horrible time. But eventually, negotiations were conducted to bring them home. And it was finally agreed between representatives of Johnson's administration and Kim Il-sung's that they would be released just before Christmas, 1968. And so there was this memorable scene at Panmunjom, when there's this terrible old concrete bridge called the Bridge of No Return. And at the appointed hour, the two North Korean army trucks with these miserable, emaciated, disheveled, unhappy-looking Americans, they didn't know what was about to happen to them, were brought in. They were told to walk across the bridge. They weren't allowed to look backwards, weren't allowed to run, not to make any gestures or anything like that. And they were being released. They were being released from a world of misery and deprivation and torture and perpetual diet of turnips and nothing else. And they were crossing the line and walking into the hands of big, smiling, suntanned Americans, offering them steak and orange juice and Christmas and freedom and all these good things. But the lovely moment was that as each man came across the border, he was greeted by the commander of all forces in South Korea, who was the now General Charles Hartwell Bonesteel III, the man who had created the mess in the first place. And of course, it strikes me that if we had never interfered at all, if we had let the Soviet Union take the whole thing, it would surely have been a communist state. But communism has effectively withered and died everywhere. I mean, look at Vietnam today, look at Cambodia, where my son lives. I mean, they're capitalist countries, socialist but capitalist. And that's probably what would have happened to Korea. And it wouldn't have been divided. You wouldn't have got the DMZ. You wouldn't have these lunatics in the north building nuclear weapons. And you wouldn't have the need for 34,000 American soldiers. So another reason not to interfere, just like the missionaries, just like Charles Bonesteel. The last thing I want to say, though, and I think I've just about got some time, it relates to this book. I think is unusually beautiful, and it's the end papers are lovely. The last end paper is a fairly standard Pacific view of the carrier Strike Force 7. I think that's the USS George Washington, I think, out of Yokosuka in Japan. But this other picture, the opening one, is a much nicer picture, I think. And that is a picture of a Hawaiian sailing canoe called the Hokulea, which is the Hawaiian word for the star Arcturus, the very bright star. And it was built in 1976 in Honolulu by a group of Hawaiians who wanted to give something to the United States as a gift for the bicentenary. But it wasn't so much the object they wanted to bring as a gift. They wanted to bring back the ancient Polynesian craft of non-instrumental navigation, because the Polynesians for thousands of years had somehow mysteriously managed to navigate across the seas without the use of anything like a wristwatch or a compass or a sextant, and of course certainly not GPS. They had managed to do it mysteriously and wonderfully just by looking at the stars and the patterns of birds and the clouds and feeling, even though it sounds rather pretentious to say so, feeling the waves under the hull of the boat. And there was only one man back in 1976 who had this skill. And he was called Mao Piaolug, and he lived on Satawal in the Caroline Islands. And so a group of Hawaiians went down to the Caroline Islands, found Satawal, found Mao Piaolug, and says, "Can you do this?" And he said, "Yes, I can." He's an elderly man. So they flew him back to Honolulu. He'd never been on a plane before. and showed him the craft they were building. And he said, this is wonderful. I mean, I can do this in this craft. So he taught the rudiments of this technique to a group of Hawaiians and said, where do you want to go? And they said, we would like to go to Tahiti, 2,500 miles south. And he said, okay, I'll plot a course and we'll get there, he said, in 6 weeks. They set off. 6 weeks to the day, they raised Tahiti directly ahead of them. And they had done it with unerring accuracy, but without any instruments at all. Everyone in Polynesia was thrilled by this, so they took the boat back to Hawaii, then they took it to a variety of other destinations. They took it to Japan, reminding the Japanese that they were Pacific people. They took it to Haida Gwaii, the Queen Charlotte Islands off the west coast of Canada. They took it to Vancouver, they took it to San Francisco, they took it to Lima, all sorts of places. And now, I mean, Pialuk himself has died, there are 300 Hawaiians, young Hawaiians, who know how to do this. And so now they've decided to demonstrate to the world what Polynesian skills are. They're taking this craft around the world. So the 14th of May 2014, and that was the date I mentioned at the beginning of this talk, they launched Hokulea from Maui, and they went down to Tahiti, which was obviously quite easy because they've done it before, and then they went, turned right and went to Samoa, and they went to Tokelau and the Cook Islands. They went to New Zealand, spent Christmas in New Zealand. Then they went across to Australia. And once, of course, they'd gone around the top of Cape York, they were entering a new ocean, the Indian Ocean, which was completely unfamiliar to them. And they're now, I checked yesterday, they're just north of Mauritius in the central western Indian Ocean, heading for the coast of Africa. And you can check their progress every day. The Polynesian Voyaging Society records where they are. And they're now making this decision of whether to turn right and go round the Horn of Africa, up through the Red Sea, into the Mediterranean, out through the Pillars of Hercules and into the Atlantic Ocean that way, or whether they turn left and go past Madagascar and join the Agulhas Current and go past Cape Agulhas and Cape of Good Hope into the Atlantic that way. But whichever way they go into the Atlantic, their ambition in the short term is that by October this coming year, 2016, they will sail up the Potomac to show their craft to their Hawaiian president. Which, if they do it, will be wonderful, I think. And then they will come down the coast, the east coast of South America, will go through the Straits of Magellan, as Magellan did in 1529, and nose out into the Pacific and be back home. It'll take 4 years for the entire journey, if they succeed, and I think they will. And talks like this, I hope, will publicize something that they're doing. And for one overarching reason, that we have for so long in the West treated the people of the East and people of the Pacific with disdain, disapprobation. We have polluted the sea, we have bombed them, we have enslaved them, we have colonized them. Now we've withdrawn from the colonies. Now we're letting the Pacific people stand on their own, and they're regaining their confidence in a way. And this extraordinary ability that the Polynesians have, and which we have not recognized, we are suddenly, those of us who know about the Polynesian Voyaging Society and Hokulea's adventure, we are in awe of what they're doing. And we are now beginning slowly, and that's why I have some hope, treating these people and the ocean with something that has been denied them for all too long, and that is respect. And that's what I hope for the future of the ocean. So thank you all very much indeed for listening.
With Fukushima and all the pollution in the Pacific Ocean, is the seafood safe to eat out of the ocean? Are there certain areas of the Pacific to get it from that are safer to get it from?
Well, it's a very good question. Generally speaking, I mean, these days, what is safe? I mean, is water safe? Isn't it full of Prozac? And isn't it full of, you know, birth control pills and all stuff like that? The bones of, there was one fish the other day in the news where people have found that there's radioactive cesium in the bones of most Pacific fish. So I think the short answer is probably no. Oddly enough, I think where McDonald's get their fish fillet of fish food from, the waters north of New Zealand, is pretty much more safe than waters that have been involved with the Kushiro, the great current in the north. I'd be wary, but I would still eat fish. It's very good for you.
Is the Atlantic better than the Pacific as well?
That's a very interesting question. I only buy fish which is labeled with the blue little oval, which says MSC, which is, I think, Marine Stewardship Council, and they say that it comes from a responsibly managed fishery. And, of course, the most irresponsibly managed fishery in the world is that of the cod fishery of the Grand Banks of Newfoundland, which was destroyed by overfishing. But the southern Atlantic fishery, where the Chilean sea bass comes from, which is, of course, neither Chilean nor a sea bass. It's actually called the Patagonian toothfish, but no one thought anyone would buy that. That, I think, is both abundant and safe. So that is probably better for you, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hello.
So you divided your book up into 10 sections. Could you go to the cutting room floor and pick out number 11 or 12?
Oh, yeah. Well, my wife is very, we have, let us call, say, robust arguments about this, because one of the stories that made that landed on the cutting room floor is a story dear to her heart, which is to do with the internment of American citizens of Japanese origin during World War II. As you all know, 1942, 120,000 people who were American citizens, but simply Japanese origin, were rounded up and deemed to be a danger to the United States and put into camps. The story I wanted to tell, which was an amazingly courageous Irish lawyer called Wayne Collins, who, when the war was over, you may possibly remember that about 5,000 of these internees were so angry with the American government that they had renounced their American citizenship and, as a consequence, had no citizenship at all, because they weren't Japanese, they weren't American, they were nothing. And America wanted to deport them, although they weren't quite sure where to deport them to. And this man, Wayne Collins, who was an amiable old drunk running a not particularly successful law practice in Oakland, in California, decided he would stop the deportation of these unfortunate stateless people and then would fight to get their citizenship back. And the American government would not permit him to do a class action suit on behalf of all 5,000. So he had to devote the rest of his life to fighting with them case by case by case by case. And finally, in 1959, they held a party in the Justice Department because the very last case, all of them successful, the very last citizenship had been given back. And I think Wayne Collins is a great hero. And I think that story would make a wonderful movie. There's an Irish actor, I don't know if any of you are familiar with him, called Brendan Gleeson, who was in a movie called The Guard and The General. And I want to write to him and say, I'll tell him the story of Wayne Collins and say, would you like to play it? So although it hit the cutting room floor, much to the chagrin and annoyance of my wife, it may one day be a movie. Who knows? So.
Yes, we are about to see massively larger container ships passing through the Panama Canal. There's some talk about a Chinese canal through Nicaragua. We've got the opening, potentially, of some sea lanes above North America. What impacts are you concerned about as a result of these changes for the Pacific?
Well, there's this German research group now which is tracking the passage of ships' pollution, atmospheric pollution from engine exhausts. And it's a bewildering and dismaying crisscrossing pattern. You see it in both the Atlantic and the Pacific, where, because the sea lanes are very fixed, and so the amount of carbon particulates above the place where these ships are passing through is very dramatically illustrated. And I'm afraid, I mean, the Central Pacific is filthy enough, but the thought of the Northwest Passage now, huge oil tankers going through that, I mean, I've traveled a great deal in the Arctic because I used to be a geologist, and we had this big interest in Greenland. And one of the wonderful things about it, similarly, of course, with the Antarctic, is their pristine purity. And the thought that, I mean, not only do we worry, or did we worry about the Alaska pipeline, with good reason, of course, but now to have gigantic ships, and we know what happened to these ships. They all say they're very safe, but they're not. They have accidents, they strand, they sink. I mean, look at the Exxon Valdez. And they produce this immense amount of particulate pollution as well. So what do we do? I was on a radio program this morning about ExxonMobil and whether it knew 20 years ago about the amount of pollution that their products were causing and how much carbon, how much greenhouse gases, and how they could have perhaps done something and didn't, and people are talking about lawsuits against ExxonMobil. Well, and we have the Paris climate talks about to begin. Is any good going to come of those? I don't know. Generally speaking, I think the whole question that you raise is deeply depressing, and I'm afraid that's another chapter. I think it's chapter 7 in this book. So, lovely jacket, but there's a lot of miserable reading in this book, I'm afraid.
So you're a geologist, as am I, and a way long time ago, I had to do a paper on the oceans, and I discovered, this is in the mid-60s, and I came across the idea that all these geophysical lines that have been run across the Pacific, somebody analyzed, a guy named Vine analyzed them and came up with the notion, and he saw that there were repeated geomagnetic changes. And eventually it led to, in my opinion, the idea of continental drift, which to that time had been poo-pooed by everybody and his dog. I wonder if you covered that in your book and what implications the whole concept has had for us.
Yeah, I mean, I do in great detail. Those experiments, which were funded by the U.S. Navy off these coasts here, Washington and Oregon, and showed the symmetry of the reversal of the magnetic fields, because as we know, the planetary magnetic field reverses every 50,000 years or so, and how these reversals spread outwards, looking like two, universal product codes. And that led everyone to realize that there was ocean floor spreading and that the continents were moving, and that this poor chap, Alfred Wegener, who was the 1912, he had said, the continents clearly had moved. I mean, it's as plain as the nose on your face. South America clearly fitted into the armpit of Africa. And they said, continents do not move. This is a heresy. And the poor man died believing that he had committed almost a mortal sin and that he was flying in the face of logic. But, of course, it turned out he was exactly right. I went to Oxford in 1963, graduated in 66. So no one in my department taught tectonic plate movement or continental drift. The theory, which was adduced by this man called Tuzo Wilson at the University of Toronto, was published in August 1965, and it revolutionized the view of the planet, as you will remember. So I'm a child of the pre-continental drift school, but now we all know, that you're living on a subduction zone. There's been this big piece in the New Yorker a few weeks ago about the Cascadia Fault. Everyone here is fairly scared at the moment, and it's all to do with tectonic plate movement. So we knew nothing of this 50 years ago. So it's a revolution, and we're all affected by knowing it.
Hi.
Hello.
Since the person I'm asking is from the San Francisco area, do you have Steve Jobs in your book?
Do I have Steve Jobs in my book? Yes, he's certainly mentioned because I had breakfast with Steve Jobs, a friend of mine called Max Whitby and I, in about the 10th of January 1984, were taken to Claridge's Hotel in London to meet this extraordinary man who had a beard and was much different looking fellow. And he told us he had this sort of messianic attitude. And he unveiled this device, which hitherto had been seen by nobody. And that was the first Macintosh, which would then, as you all remember, be announced to the world in the Super Bowl advertisement made by Ridley Scott, that amazing ad, one of the greatest ads in history, I think. So I got to see a Mac before most other people. So I feel a great sense of privilege. And certainly that man, neither Max, who's still a great friend of mine in London, nor I have ever forgotten that meeting. So I know there's been all this hoopla and all this hype, and to be perfectly honest, I'm tired of all these movies and books about Steve Jobs. So if Jobs is in here, there's only a couple of lines. I hope you're not going to be distressed by there aren't pages and pages about him. But certainly he had very much an effect on me, and I'm a complete Mac addict to this day.
How clean do you think around Hawaii, how clean do you think the waters are since we go there quite a bit?
Well, the North Atlantic Gyre, of course, is just to the northeast of Hawaii. I mean, if you draw a straight line from Oahu to Vancouver, it'll go right through the middle of the gyre, which is a filthy part of the ocean. You don't run into a wall of, you know, plastic milk crates and detergent bottles. It's mostly microscopic fragments. But in terms of the absorption of plastic by fish, a great deal is going on there. The waters immediately around Hawaii are pristine and beautiful. I wouldn't worry too much. I mean, I lived there for a long time and I'm still relatively healthy. But if you're a fish and you pass a lot of seawater through your gills, then beware of all the plastic 500 miles northeast of Hawaii. So, but you don't have gills, I don't think, anyway. Right, well, that's probably it, isn't it? In which case, thank you all very much indeed for coming.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. If you liked what you heard, you might leave a good review. It does help other listeners find us. Simon Winchester's new book is Pacific: Silicon Chips and Surfboards, Coral Reefs and Atom Bombs, Brutal Dictators, Fading Empires, and the Coming Collision of the World's Superpowers. He spoke at Town Hall Seattle on November 4th, 2015. This talk was presented by Town Hall Seattle and the Elliott Bay Book Company as part of the Seattle Science Lectures. Thanks to Anna Tatashev for our recording.